Today on Straight Talk Africa, the role of development partners in promoting democracy and good governance in Africa. Is it a myth or reality? That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. It's Wednesday, April 6th. I am Shaka Sali.
Hello, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Ian Bior, your social media reporter, standing in for Mariama Diallo.
Today, we'll talk about the role of development partners in promoting democracy and good governance in Africa.
And coming up later in our STA inbox, our audience has weighed in on our topic through emails and Facebook comments, and we'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
Democracy in Africa is at a crossroads, with some countries making reasonable progress, while others are sliding back to dictatorship. My colleague Estagizui Yuwat has more on the story.
Indeed, democracy and good governance in Africa has seen gains and, in other cases, reversals. The survival of democratic institutions largely depends on free and fair elections, as well as transparency in electoral commissions. Then there's the issue of fair and competitive elections. Earlier this year in Uganda, the main opposition candidate Kizza Besigye was arrested and rearrested even long after the elections were over. Ugandan lawyer Nicholas Opio says the country needs to overhaul a biased and weak system.
You have a head of state with a lot of advantage over other candidates, so we need to reform the laws to plug those loopholes, and that is going to be a political process, not a legal process.
In West Africa, Benin stood out as an emerging democracy with about 4.7 million eligible voters casting their ballots to elect a successor to outgoing President Thomas Boni Yayi. Businessman Patrice Talon won the second round of the presidential election. His challenger, former Prime Minister Alain Osinsu, called Talon to congratulate him on his victory. In Niger, President Mahamadou Issoufou was sworn in for a second term after a disputed vote, which was also boycotted by the opposition. Professor Atahiru Jega is former chairman of Nigeria's Electoral Commission.
Electoral commissions all over Africa need to pay attention to voter education, to sensitization and public enlightenment, because inclusiveness and participation of citizens in elections is very, very important for the governance.
Countries such as Somalia are often referred to as failed states. For decades, efforts to bring stability to a transitional government have been met with pushback and rebellion. The current threat of Al-Shabaab militants have made the country ungovernable and destabilized the region. Unemployed youths from Libya to Eritrea are making perilous journeys to Europe, where they hope for a better future as migrants. Still, other countries like South Africa prove that in a democracy, anyone can be held accountable for misuse of public funds. President Jacob Zuma is facing a political storm to impeach him. The last few weeks, he has been taken to task for using public funds to make some improvements in a private home.
That I never knowingly or deliberately set out to violate the Constitution, which is the supreme law of the Republic. I have agreed to pay for the identified items once a determination is made.
Tanzania's election late last year was hailed as a success, but there was chaos in the island of Zanzibar, where the elections were nullified. In Central Africa, some incumbent presidents have used political maneuvers to remain in power. Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza claims his presidency is by divine authority, but plunged the country into bloodshed by running for a controversial third term. In Rwanda, President Paul Kagame will be running for another term that could potentially see him in power through 2034. He changed the constitution through a controversial referendum. DRC's President Joseph Kabila has yet to announce he will not run for yet another term later this year. Analysts say there are strong indications he is not ready to leave office. In Congo Brazzaville, longtime President Denis Sassou Nguesso shut down social media and phones while campaigning to extend his 32-year rule. John Prendergast, CEO and founder of Enough Project, says the temptation for leaders seeking to extend their terms is too great, but that's not all.
They perceive themselves to have immunity while in power. They fear leaving power, suddenly losing that immunity and being prosecuted for any number of things, mostly corruption, but also some of the human rights abuses that occurred during their tenures.
The Central African Republic endured long political wrangles that divided the country along religious lines. About a week ago, transitional president Catherine Samba Panza handed over power to Faustin Touadera, who, like others in the continent, swore to defend the constitution of his country. CAR citizens hope he will keep his word. Africa is ready for change from greed and political chaos and their dreadful human toll. Esther Githu Ewart, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Esther, for that interesting report. Now joining us here in our Washington studios are three distinguished guests. Beth Treter, Vice President of the Department of Policy and Evaluation at the Millennium Challenge Corporation. Dr. J. Peter Palm, Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Emira Woods, an Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Well, welcome to you all.
Great to be with you. Nice to be with
you, Shaka. You're most welcome, and a bit for you, of course, the first time that I have the opportunity to host you.
But hopefully not the last.
Hopefully not the last indeed. Now, talk to me, Betty, when we talk about development partners, promoting democracy and good governance in Africa. From your experience, is it a myth or a reality?
Well, I think it's a reality. I mean, let's be clear that the hard work really needs to be done by the countries themselves. But I think development partners have an important role to play in incentivizing that and actually in creating a dividend for that kind of commitment to democracy. The way MCC does that is through really our selectivity. Mm-hmm. We look at all of the low-income and lower-middle-income countries around the world every year. And then we look at how they measure up to their peers on a host of independent third-party indicators that cover issues related to governance, including economic freedom, whether countries are investing in their people, and whether they're embracing democratic rights. And we're highly selective. In fact, this past year, only 29 of those 81 countries that we looked at actually passed their scorecards and were considered for partnerships with MCC.
Now, when you talk about those countries that qualify for the MCC, we are talking about two categories here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about threshold. We're talking about compact. Mm-hmm. And compact is really the real deal. How many, first of all, in fact, our audience might want to know, what is the difference between those two, threshold and compact?
Well, we like to think that both of them are the real deal because we think that both of them could be extremely helpful for helping countries to achieve their aspirations for economic growth and poverty reduction, which is the mission of MCC, and it's the only mission that MCC has. A threshold program generally runs from around $15 million to about $50 million, and threshold programs are for countries that don't quite pass the MCC's scorecard yet, but that we see good promise in, that we see a trajectory toward passage and a trajectory toward compact eligibility. I would say compacts are for the best performers on the scorecard and also for countries that that we know are showing a commitment to democratic governance and control of corruption. And that is a very small club indeed.
Very small club indeed.
And compacts bring with them the potential for significant resources. So on average, compacts are around $350 million. And we're very heavily invested in things that other donors with grant money aren't invested in, like infrastructure. In fact, almost three quarters of our portfolio is invested in infrastructure.
Very interesting. What about you, Peter? Is it a myth or a reality, really?
Well, I think it can be a reality. And increasingly it is. But two conditions have to prevail. First, the development partner has to have the political will to actually insist upon these conditions. And secondly, there has to be the agency of the country receiving the assistance to really want these reforms and to be incentivized properly, as Beth has pointed out. Let me give you an example. In 2009, before Beth's time there, MCC awarded a compact to Senegal 5 months after the president appointed his own son Minister of Transport, Regional Integration, Energy, International Cooperation. Now, how is that good governance? But the compact for over $500 million went through nonetheless. That was a lack of political will on our part in the United States to hold that government accountable. On the other hand, there's some great successes. Last year, a compact was signed, a second one with Benin. And that was after it had been suspended briefly, the elaboration of this compact, over corruption issues. But here there was an incentive, a credible incentive on the part of the U.S., and the government of Benin wanted to deal with these problems. They dealt with them and got the compact. So I think when both conditions exist, this can be a real boost. But when there's the lack of political will on either part, then we have a problem.
You could, of course, also mention Madagascar, because at one time, in fact, was part of the compact and was suspended. And then you have, of course, Ghana, which, of course, increasingly is becoming perhaps a beacon of hope for African democracy.
Yes.
What about you, Emira? Is it a reality or is it a myth?
Well, Shaka, for me, I appreciate being on with the other panelists, but clearly it's a myth, right? If you think about democracy, Shaka, democracy is rule of the people, for the people, by the people. First of all, it has to be rooted in communities throughout the continent taking hold of their own destiny. That is what will determine good governance, is ensuring that there is a free press. It's not just it's elections or election commissions. It goes beyond that. It's the freedom of the press. It's the freedom of people to access information. There are these underpinnings of good governance and democracy that, you know, no external agent can impose, to be quite frank, right? And I think we have to also put the MCC in its context. I mean, I think clearly it's important to have a Millennium Challenge account, but it is separate from the U.S. Agency for International Development, separate from the State Department, smaller in numbers. And we have to be really frank. It is actually the Department of Defense of the U.S. that is much more engaged in terms of African countries that need to have the scrutiny of good governance than any other agency of the U.S. government. So, you know, I mean, it feels almost as if it's token, you know, to say we will, in rhetoric, put forward these principles of good governance. But in reality, it is the U.S. interest, particularly in, if you take, you know, the resources of the continent, in economic resources, particularly oil, natural gas, mining, you know, and now increasingly this lens of ISIS and terrorism, right? It is those lenses that are driving how the U.S. engages. It is much less issues of democracy, issues of good governance.
Very interesting. How do you react to that, Beth?
Well, I would say that I agree with Amira's statement about the importance of empowering people to take responsibility for their own exercise of democracy, frankly, and that, you know, democracy is built from the ground up. And I think that we at MCC, we consider part of our job to help countries strengthen the compact between citizens and their government in the way that we can. Now, certainly we can't do everything as a donor agency, as a development partner, but by incentivizing a commitment to democracy, by incentivizing a fight against corruption, that's one way we do that. And as you and as Peter were also saying, you know, we do have the power to suspend and terminate our compacts when we feel that our partner countries are going back on their commitments to democracy and good governance. Now, that's not the whole of the U.S. government relationship with these countries. Amira is absolutely right about that. But that is MCC's piece in the puzzle.
Very interesting. Now we'll pause for a short break. Would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now on the social networking website Twitter, and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka, and join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA Democracy Governance, and we are still on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa. become a fan and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question, keep your comment brief, and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui-Ewart. And of course, this is Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from Washington. Let me come to you, Peter. You know, when we go to Africa, the bottom line is that the primary stakeholder is the African citizen. But some will tell you that African citizen is increasingly being treated as if he or she were a subject. Are you concerned about increasing opinion on the continent that elections, at least most of the elections held across the African continent, are not in fact meant for those primary stakeholders, but for development partners?
Well, increasingly, unfortunately, there is this trend. You know, when I first got into Africa, we still had presidents for life. Now, with the solitary exception of Eritrea, everyone holds elections, although, to quote my good friend Ambassador John Campbell, some of these are more like election-like events rather than elections. And so, increasingly, we do have this disparity between the will of the people and what takes place. But I think the most important thing is that we have to look at this in the broader scope, which is, increasingly, we do see citizens being empowered either through the ballot box or increasingly through social media and other communications. This isn't your father's or much less your grandfather's generation. And so it's going to be increasingly difficult and challenging for the continent's remaining strongmen to continue to keep their citizens out of the process. And so history is on the side of those who are moving toward reform, but the reform has to come from within. It has to be African agency, and this is where I agree with Amir, has to be respected. Because if Africans themselves, ordinary citizens, don't have ownership of the process, it really won't have that legitimacy nor the sustainability.
It's very interesting, Peter, that you point out the exception of Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea, out of 54 member countries of the African Union. And yet, frankly, you call the other elections events. You talk about Ethiopia, for example, where someone jokingly referred to Ethiopia as having a perfect democracy, because there is not a single member of parliament that comes from the opposition. Everybody is from the ruling party. You talk to Uganda. You talk about Uganda. You just had an election, or an event for that matter. You saw the kind of intimidation. You saw the kind of violence. You saw everything, and you call it an event. You move on to Rwanda, for example, where you have perfect referendum. Is that real?
Well, I think, Shaka, just take one of them. You've laid out quite a number of things we could talk about. I like to look at a glass half full rather than half empty. In the case of Uganda, we certainly have some serious concerns about the way that election was conducted. But the fact that the ruling party had to put in as many resources to get the result they wanted, and the fact that they lost the cities and had to rely on the countryside to pull things through, that means the next time around, it's not going to be that easy. So increasingly, yes, it must be frustrating if you're in the political opposition, et cetera, but you can see the incremental gains. You cannot keep a lid on something that's boiling forever. And I think this is what's happening across the continent at various speeds, et cetera. But I think this is This is the march of history throughout the continent. Those who try to keep it down are just building up the pressures. And I think that's the key thing to keep our eye on is incrementally we are moving in the direction where it should be going. Do we have reverses? Most certainly. But I think we have to keep an eye on that progress and try to sustain it. And as you often say, keep that hope alive.
Where to go? Now, Emira, as an African, and as an African, of course, in the diaspora, you obviously have observed that you've been on the continent and you have watched elections or selections, some will call them. Do you agree with Peter, especially frankly talking about at least there are some periodic elections taking place? Is that frankly what Africa needs? Aren't you probably better off in Eritrea where there's no pretense of an event? Aren't you probably better off under Libya's brother leader, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, for 42 years with no pretense of an election, rather than wasting resources, actually, trying to please the development partners that you are actually in a democratic process?
No, well, Shaka, I think the issue is, you know, people need control of their own destiny. And so what you have throughout the continent is people clamoring to have a greater say in determining their future. When people see the economy is not working, increasing unemployment, increasing inequality throughout the continent, people are clamoring both for economic and for political change. And it is those clamorings that I believe, you know, they cannot go unheeded. It is particularly young people using music, using technology, using all kinds of ways to express their will. And I see these gains that are happening. Some of it is through the electoral process. Some of it is through people taking to the streets. Look what happened in Burkina Faso. No one imagined that, you know, Blaise Compaoré would be ousted by young people, by musicians taking to the streets, leading demonstrations, demanding change. You know, I think it is that people power, whether it's the students in South Africa that started a Fees Must Fall campaign that has led to this crescendo that is putting such pressure on the ANC, the oldest political party on the African continent, is now being pressured by its standard bearer to be impeached or resign, right? Because of this pressure that came from the bottom up, from young people, from workers, trade unionists. You know, so I think it is this clamoring that will bring the change. And the clamoring will bring changes not only in electoral processes, but in across the board, in opening up the political space, whether it's through new political parties that will reflect the will of the people, whether it's through new forms of organizing workers combined with farmers and rurals combined with shops and all of these forces joining hands with students and young people. This is what is, I believe, the lesson of history. This is what has brought the end to the colonial period, and this is what I believe will bring the true freedom that's needed both politically and economically on the continent.
Peter said that, for example, in Uganda's last election, the ruling party lost in the urban centers, but it did have support in the rural villages, the rural country. I don't know sometimes why people assume the fact that people in rural areas did not go to school, do not express their opinion, automatically support a dictator.
You know, I think we have to challenge that. I don't think it's an issue of formal schooling. People are incredibly intelligent. They understand the lives that they're living are worse than the lives that their grandparents lived. It's quite simple. They, throughout, whether they have been formally educated or not, know that the system is rigged against them and are clamoring for a way to change that status quo, to change that system so that their children can live better lives. So I don't think we should in any way stigmatize those who are less formally educated. The intelligence is there. People understand in their gut that these demands must be heard. And so I believe it's coming not only from urban centers, but from rural areas. And unfortunately, there have been ways to clamp down on those clamorings. But increasingly, I believe that is the change that the continent and the world needs.
Very interesting. Would you like to react to that?
Yeah. And what I'm referring to is actually just the statistical breakdown of the vote, rather than a judgment on rural people. I think part of it is the levers of power in some of these countries. It's a lot easier to clamp down, you know, the use of Social media is much less prevalent in rural areas. Local authorities, often apparatchiks of incumbent ruling parties, have greater say over people's lives. And so the pressure points are there. But the point I want to make more broadly is consonant with what Avera said, is the young people, the urban population, you can't hold them down. They're pushing back, and that is going to simply spread and increase. So I think governments now are going to have to not only win these electoral events, but they also have to gain legitimacy. And legitimacy comes from delivering good governance, delivering goods and services that people expect and know to expect.
You know, there was a man in Burkina Faso called Beautiful Blaise. Blaise Compaoré, a man who allegedly might have killed Captain Sankara back in 1984. This is a man that was in power for 27 good years. And yet, when he tried to change the constitution so as to hang on to power, he was actually removed from power by what was characterized as people power. But that people power was mainly concentrated in the capital, Ouagadougou. Why is it that the people who support him, for example, in rural areas, were not factored into his living office?
I think it's where populism are contrary. This is Africa. Most people don't realize, those of us who follow Africa know, but Africa is one of the fastest urbanizing areas in the world. By mid-century, two-thirds of Africans will be living in cities. These are where the large cities are growing. And when people live together, all sorts of things, interesting things happen. The cost of infrastructure and communications goes down. People exchange ideas. People are contrary. They can't be dispersed. They're connected with each other. And so we're really at an inflection point of a whole new model of society. And this is very exciting, but it can also be, if you're holding to power by your fingernails, this could be also a very disconcerting period in time.
Very interesting. Now, Beth, talk to us about your recent decision, or your board's decision, on Tanzania. What did you actually decide? Was it suspending? Was it... what did you do? What did you decide to do?
Well, the board of MCC, we're governed by a board which is made up of both U.S. government officials and also private individuals. And the board made a decision late last month to suspend the MCC's partnership with Tanzania. And it was broadly over concerns about the government of Tanzania's commitment to democratic governance. And it was really driven by two specific things. The first, as I think it was referenced in the video before, was the nullification of the election on Zanzibar in October, and then the subsequent rerun of that election in late March in a way that was neither fair nor inclusive. And the second was the application of the cybercrimes law in a way that appears to be impinging on the freedom of speech and association of people in Tanzania. So based on those two factors, which the board and MCC itself has communicated about to the government of Tanzania in the past, the board decided to suspend the partnership.
And we are talking, of course, here about $472 million?
We are indeed.
What does the government of Tanzania have to do? What does it need to do? What should it do in order to access this money?
Well, the board has made its concerns very clear. And as I said, these are not concerns that just emerged in time for the board meeting to happen. These are concerns that have been very well communicated and thoroughly communicated with the government in the past. So I guess we'll have to see how the government decides to respond to those concerns. And then the board will have to decide if that response warrants a lifting of the suspension.
Would that, for example, include perhaps... acknowledging the results of Zanzibar of last October?
Well, I have to say that it's really up to the government to decide how it would like to respond to the concerns. We at MCC, we don't give checklists. What we do, we sort of set out broad parameters and principles, and then we ask that our partners make a commitment to adhere to those principles.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment. But first, here is Ian Bior. Take it away, Ian.
Thanks, Shaka. And still to come, we'll reveal some of the outstanding feedback we've received from our audience through social media. But now, here's our letter of the week from a Straight Talk Africa Facebook fan. Our letter of the week comes from Omanua Okubo from Nigeria, who writes, "Leadership, democracy, and good governance is about the public office holders as well as members of the civil society. If Africa's development partners want development for the African continent, they must emphasize the need for a very high standard of education among the populace of African states. Development partners must also emphasize the need for the joint setting of short, medium, and long-term goals, and the need to faithfully implement the plan stated in such goals. Development in Africa will be minimal if members of civil society feel helpless or have an inferiority complex towards the politicians and government."
I wanted to present music and a side of American culture that is most important to me, that is a part of who I am. They're going to get some incredible performances. That's one of the things I love, bringing these artists in so you can get to see them do what they do. It's soul music, and that's what music is. It's that which comes from the soul.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number 202-619-3111. And the U.S. country code is 1. Call us collects and we'll pay for the call. Or call directs and we'll call you right back. Remember to keep your questions brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui Ewart, and welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. Once again, it's time to bring in my colleague and social media reporter. Take it away again.
Thanks, Shaka. We received tremendous feedback in our STA inbox to this week's question. The Millennium Challenge Corporation's board of directors voted recently to suspend its partnership with the government of Tanzania due to actions inconsistent with MCC's eligibility criteria. This leads us to our question of the week, which asks, what role do you think development partners should take in promoting democracy and good governance in Africa? Before we begin, I'd like to thank all of you for using our social media platform to communicate with us. And another reminder that we are tweeting live today. Use the hashtag VOA Democracy Governance. And if you haven't yet, please follow us at VOA Shaka. And speaking of, let's go to a tweet from Mozem, who tweets, development partners need to take a decisive role. Prior methods don't seem to work effectively. In fact, they favor despots. Now to a comment from Facebook fan Nikodemo Nkezi in Arusha, Tanzania, who writes, the development partners have nothing to do with developing Africa because their real intent is not to develop Africa, but to get what they want. They support leaders who can satisfy their own interest and not the interests of the people. Well, Shaka, two thought-provoking yet critical views here. What's your take?
Very interesting. Let me toss it to Beth. Your reaction?
My reaction is that if an organization is using an incentive structure, I think there is great incentive for a country to do the right thing. But I would also agree that this needs to be in the hands of the people. And I think that what you saw recently with the board's decision to suspend Tanzania was in direct response, really, to what the people on Zanzibar were experiencing. So there is a direct connection between, in this case, the action of a development partner and the will of the people. That's not to say that it always works that way, but I think there are examples where you see what the people want really have an impact on what happens between a development partner and a developing country government.
And what are those other branches, for example, of the U.S. government, really? Where are they when they are needed in this context?
Well, I think let's be frank, Shaka. Every country in the world pursues in its foreign policy its interests. And where countries have good relations, it's where interests converge. And I think on development issues and good governance, America's interests, whether it be in stability and security, whether it be in economic partnerships, all converge with Africans' interests in good governance and democracy. Our best economic partners are countries that are open and societies that are transparent. Our most stable countries are those where the governments are legitimate in the eyes of the people. Now, does this work sometimes when we have policymakers of either party who have to make decisions or feel they have to make decisions based on short-term interests or decisions, you know, certainly sometimes it's less than ideal. But at the end of the day, if one is really looking at it, our long-term interests and those of our friends do converge, because what they want, legitimacy in government and service, are what we want, because that makes for more stable partners, more prosperous countries with whom we can do business.
Emira, I don't have problems, obviously, for countries to have their own vital national security interests. But when you talk about African interests, really, are these African people's interests, or are they interests, probably, of those individuals who occupy State House at some point in time?
Yeah, well, you know, Shaka, you hit the nail on the head always. It is, you know, interests being very narrowly defined. If you think about even the interest for the U.S., it's often defined by U.S. companies interested in Africa's natural resources. Very narrowly defined. It's also defined by the U.S. military right now, very focused on countering terrorism. Very narrowly defined, often out of very short-term interests that are driven by a narrow elite. I love that we now have the Panama Papers that can shed some light on the elite and how it's working, right? But it is these relationships that are rigging the rules. And often, you know, you think about the longest relationship the U.S. and Africa is Egypt, right? I mean, Egypt, which was for a long time strongest partner with the U.S., second in terms of assistance from the U.S.
after Israel. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, was a military dictatorship and still is today a military dictatorship.
And
right?
There was no coup.
In spite of the fact that there is no democracy, the U.S. maintains it as a number one ally and partner. Why? Because of a very narrow analysis of U.S. interests. And I think we've got to unpack that and question it. And I'm so grateful for the straight talk of the folks like the person in Arusha who gave the comment, because I think we have to look with a critical eye. And this is an opportunity to do that.
We'll come back to that and more later. Ayen, do you have more reaction from the audience, please?
Yes, we do have more reaction. In fact, let's go to another comment from a Facebook fan, Ayn Ronald in Bushenyi, Uganda, who writes, Shaka, I think good governance is not the epitome for development in Africa. It's a fallacy. We need a new direction in almost every sector. This includes prior economic systems that excluded the so-called developing partners. Those systems were used to stifle, exploit, and change our education systems and culture. And our last Facebook comment comes from Magezi Wilson, who writes, development partners in Africa should preach the gospel of democracy, adhering to term limits and to emulate the USA as a role model. Shaka, a few interesting suggestions here. What's your take?
Very interesting, Beth. Of course, you had someone saying that perhaps what is needed may in fact be a new paradigm shift. Your reaction?
I don't know that that's necessary. I think there are a lot of tools out there that can be used to good effect. And I'd say that one of the key themes that I think has emerged over the conversation over the sustainable development goals in the last several years has been the conversation about the availability of data and transparency. And I think that a lot of times it's used by development partners to talk about, how we need to be accountable to our stakeholders here at home. So in the case of MCC, the American taxpayer. But I think just as important, it's to be accountable to our stakeholders in developing countries. The people deserve to know what's coming into their country, what it's being spent on, what the priorities are, and not only to know that, but to have a hand in actually setting those priorities. And I think that if donor agencies, if development partners work with developing countries together to make sure that the kinds of funds that are going into those countries are actually in line with the priorities of the people, and that the people have a voice in determining what that money's spent on, and then that there's an accountability loop to make sure that people understand, you know, whether those dollars actually achieved the objectives they were designed to achieve, that's where progress is going to come from. And that will feed into increasing democracy, as Amira said, from the bottom up.
Very interesting, because in fact, there needs to be accountability, but accountability to who? You see, earlier I talked about who is the primary stakeholder in Africa. African leaders who are less democratic, they hold organized elections for the purpose of pleasing or pandering to the development partners. That is who they count to, not their own people.
And I think, but however, Shaka, I think that's changing. And I think Beth is being a little modest. You know, if you want to talk about paradigm shifts, the creation of the Millennium Challenge Corporation was itself a significant paradigm shift in development relationships. It set out objective criteria, which these countries have to are measured against, the very indices. It also lays out, it involves them in designing the compacts. Once they pass the threshold stage, they lay out what their major infrastructure or structural agenda is, and it's a dialogue between partners. So that itself is a shift. Is it perfect? Certainly not, but it's certainly, we've come a long way. It was developed under the Bush administration, and the Obama administration has maintained the same high levels of engagement and funding for it. So I think this is a, it's a work in progress, but I think we have to acknowledge that the development assistance paradigm is certainly not what it was when you and I began our careers working on Africa. And it's shifting, and it will probably change in the coming years.
Very interesting. Thank you very much, Ayin, for sharing with us this week's audience reaction.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. And that does it for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate to us. Please keep them coming. And if you are a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com. Or you can join our YouTube channel, sign up to VOA TV to Africa, and follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website, or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the app. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now, let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program. Next week on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the International Criminal Court and African leaders. Join host Shaka Sali, his panel of guests, and me, Ayen Bior, your social media reporter, as we talk about the ICC ruling of Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto. That's next week on Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome back, and today we are talking about the role of development partners in promoting democracy and good governance in Africa. Our distinguished guests are Beth Treta, Vice President of the Department of Policy and Evaluation at the Millennium Challenge Corporation, Dr. J. Peter Palm, Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Emira Woods, an Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having us.
You're most welcome. Beth, are you enjoying the show?
Of course I'm enjoying the show.
Talk to us more about what you'd like our audience, for example, to hear about your wonderful work at the Millennium Challenge Corporation.
Excellent. Well, I will say that, that as Peter said so eloquently, and I want to thank you for the assist, Peter, you know, we are a relatively new development agency that has a fairly unique model, and that's that we're focused on accountability and transparency, both in what we do and also what our partners are doing. I mean, we're really focused on working in partnership with our partners. We don't go into a country with a preconceived notion about what we're going to do and what we're going to spend money on, but we trust that that we can work together with our partners to make those determinations. And we're very evidence-based and data-based in terms of the decisions that we make. We base the decisions about how to spend the money on an economic analysis that's conducted by the country partner itself. And then the country partner itself sets up a team to actually implement the program in country. We have a very light footprint around the world. We don't send a whole team out. We send just a couple people to each country that we're working with. Mm-hmm. And we also have a model that tries to pull in the private sector to development as well in appropriate ways. So helping to create an enabling environment for the private sector to thrive. And that, I think, comes comes back to the theme of today's show, which is on good governance. But we also go about our business in a very participatory way. So the Millennium Challenge Account committees that are set up in each country, they are governed by a board of directors that's made up of, just like our own board of directors is, that's made up of both government officials and also non-governmental representatives, representatives of civil society, the private sector. And we engage in a constant dialogue with our countries about their commitment to the core standards of MCC, which are a commitment to fighting corruption and commitment to democratic governance. And then we're extremely transparent about the fact that, as you pointed out, there are times when we feel like we can no longer work with countries, and we take appropriate action in those cases. But we feel like we have a very good partnership with countries, precisely because we have a dialogue that's built on a basis of transparency, accountability, and mutual respect.
Very interesting. Sounds like a terrific model, Peter, isn't it?
It is, but it is a work in progress. There's still kinks to be worked out, and it's a model that's developing. There are other models. If we go around the world, there are other models. For example, the French Development Agency has a very strong private sector component within it, Proparco, which actually invests alongside private money to spur certain sectors of the economy and countries to get certain things that perhaps goods that couldn't be provided any other way without some sort of a little stimulus. And there are other models. And I think we're in an exciting time in history when development partners and developing partners are trying these new models. Some will land by the wayside, but others, I think, will take off. So I think we're at that inflection point. It's one that I think leads for a very interesting future, as long as we keep our eye on those core values of good governance, participation, and transparency in what we're about.
Can I just add?
Sure.
You know, one of the things that I think we've found that's been extremely interesting, and I don't know that it's something that we anticipated when the MCC was first set up, but that we're very heavily invested in Africa. We've signed 19 compacts with 15 African countries, and MCC has a fairly known brand in Africa, perhaps more than elsewhere in the world. And what we found is that our partner countries and prospective partner countries often talk to each other about mm-hmm. their relationship with MCC, about how to improve that relationship, and about how to gain eligibility. So what this model has done is, even absent our involvement, has set up a system of interconnections on the continent between countries that are looking to improve their performance and gain access to the type of resources that we have to offer.
Very interesting. Emira Woods, wouldn't you agree, frankly, that this is a terrific model? And if so, how come the other branches, for example, the United States government, cannot apply it? Because you know as well as I do that there are a lot of studies that have been done, a lot of research that has been conducted, and says if you want to achieve long-term stability, really, the route to that is democracy. It is democracy, is respect for fundamental human rights. President Barack Obama himself has actually said at one time that even in prosperity, living in prosperity without freedoms is a form of poverty. Does he simply talk the talk and can't perhaps walk the walk?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of talking the talk and not walking the walk, Shaka, unfortunately. Mm. And I think, you know, we've got to... I think we're in a moment now where we've got to challenge the models, to be quite frank, right? I think the models are deepening the inequality, and we've got to begin to recognize that the models are privileging those that are still in very elite positions. And so what you have is a relationship, particularly with a model of development that says you privatize and you look to the private sector as your solution. And I think what we've seen is that, you know, the private sector can be problematic. Probably the most extreme example going on right this week. You know, I'm from Liberia. Mm-hmm. Right this week in Liberia is privatizing their education system, right? Essentially selling off the education system to an external company, right? The private sector company, a U.S. company, to run the education system of Liberia. So I think, you know, we've got to question these models. What is the long-term interest of a U.S. private sector entity in Liberia's education for its its children for its future? I think we've got to ask those questions, understand what are the long-term implications of these development decisions, and what is the role of partners in the models that they're presenting in essentially pushing a path that is, I think, you know, particularly when you think about privatized education, even in the U.S., being questioned, for then the private sector to be seen as a solution in Africa is incredibly fallible. So we've got to challenge these models and look to perhaps other alternatives that will actually seek the long-term interests of Africa, of Africa's children, of the environment, particularly in wake of climate change. It is not the private sector, the actors that are often thinking about issues of labor rights, issues of environmental damage, issues of long-term health and well-being of the people. And I think it is fundamentally those issues that have to be prioritized in any kind of a development paradigm that's put forward in the 21st century.
Emira, talking about education, of course, for any country to develop, you have to talk about education, education, education. What about the current education model in Liberia? How is it? Is it good? Does it function?
It doesn't function, right?
So what is your problem?
We can have a whole show debating that, right? But the issue that we're discussing now is the private sector, right? Particularly a U.S. private sector entity that's going into Liberia to now take over the education system. What are the long-term implications of that for teachers, for administrators, for educating children in a country that's, you know, come out of 26 years of war? Now, 10 years later, we're still looking at chaos. We've got to begin to build infrastructure from the bottom up, understand that it is not going to be private sector, external actors, you know, coming from the U.S. private sector or elsewhere, that will be the panacea, right? And so this is what we've got to question these models. It is what is the long-term impact on not just this generation, but future generations. That's what's at stake when we have these conversations.
Emira, I know that you are a very imaginative, innovative, creative individual with a Harvard and Columbia University pedigree. Do you have any serious suggestions here? How can the development partners, for example, honestly, help the average African person? If you were to give some suggestions, what would those be?
Well, it would be first changing the economic model. We have put forward a neoliberal economic model that has failed for much of Africa, right? That has increased unemployment, increased inequality. We've got to begin to recognize that. And, you know, it's amazing. We're in a U.S. campaign season, electoral season, where people are talking about alternative economic models. I think it is fundamentally that. And from that, we've got to also think about ways through which governments can be reinforced, right? It is government spending on health, on education, on infrastructure, roads, right? That builds healthy societies for the future. So we've got to create mechanisms through which, you know, governments are using their resources not for external elite interests, but for the interests of developing the country for now and into the future. Fundamentally, these are what the changes that would be needed, not only in a Liberia, but throughout the continent.
Peter, you seem to be itching to jump in, Kaz.
Well, I think I agree with Emira insofar as the international community and Africa's partners shouldn't impose from the outside their preconceived notions of what will work. But I think equally we need to be reticent about imposing our own phobias, et cetera. You know, I hear a fear of the private sector, a questioning of neoliberal models, all that. You know, Africans have agency. They should. Liberia, I'm agnostic on what Liberia does with its educational system, but we should allow the Liberian people and their elected government to experiment in the spirit of experimentation. I think it's very telling that Emira, my dear sister, that mentions the interests of teachers before she mentions those of students. And I think that the Liberian students and their parents and the government they've elected make these decisions, and if it doesn't work, they can switch course.
That is, of course, if, in fact, they had the opportunity to elect a government. Because in most African countries, I don't think I can give you more than 15 out of 54. People actually don't have that luxury of electing a government.
That's such a critical issue. Do people choose their leaders freely and hold those leaders accountable? Is there a political space to debate these issues that are so fundamental to the future of the country? Mm. This is what's at stake when we talk about democracy and good governance.
But I think we can agree Liberia certainly is one of those countries where there is a robust democratic system and free and fair elections.
Something close to that, correct?
we can have, again, a whole other show on that, right? I mean, clearly, you know, there's a long ways to go as we move towards elections in Liberia in 2017. You know, there's a lot to be seen in terms of will the will of the people be expressed and be accepted. There's a lot in terms of the institutions that are needed to make sure that there is a free flow of political discussion and debate throughout the country, you know, that the majority of people are able to have their say. So, well, much still to be seen. Let's stay tuned.
There are some individuals, in fact, on the African continent who would like to get an opportunity to have their say. Let's go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Patrick from Nigeria. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Good evening, Mr. Shaka, and good evening, our guest, Patrick Okorafor, here in Anachukwu, Nigeria.
Usually terrific.
I want to find out from our guest, madam. Education is one of the dividends of democracy. Today in Africa, religious leaders build schools with money from the laity, that is, from the people. But the tuition fees, very, very high. The poor people there cannot school. Madam, why is it so? Today, research work also have shown that education is for sale. Is it true or false? Thank you very much, Mr. Shaka, and I'm our guest in the studio.
Thank you very much. Just hold the answer. Mira, let me go to the other caller. Good evening, Emon Kanywanisa from Uganda. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Hey, sir, how are you, Mr. Shaka, and your viewer, and all the panelists in the viewer studio?
Usually terrific. What is your question? Time is not our best ally, please.
I understand that in Africa, of course, there is a situation where you cannot speak the right issue, whereby someone can actually table an issue which can actually make defending the situation where you are living in. For instance, like the election in Uganda, you can see what has happened this. Hello?
Hello?
Hello? What has happened in Uganda, for instance, where the Colonel Dr. Kizza Besigye has won the election and has not even allowed to get out in the house where he is living, saying that the moment he gets out, he is going to cause a situation where people can live and understanding.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, I don't think we have an excellent line from Uganda. Emira, your reaction to the question from Patrick about education?
Yeah, Patrick, education is critical. And so I think it is important for people throughout the continent to have these debates. And I think the issue is not a critique of the private sector, phobia, as you say, Peter, of the private sector, but it's understanding that there's an economic model, a neoliberal model that has been put forward for Africa. And I think we've got to begin to challenge those models and understand that there is a critical role for people to play. People have that agency that we've been talking about, right? To be able to choose their futures, to be able to control their destiny. This is what people across the continent are clamoring for. So, you know, ultimately, how do we create a space where people can determine their own future, can choose their leaders, can hold those leaders accountable, can ensure that the leaders are seeking their interests in providing services that meet their needs and not seeking the interests of outsiders, whether they're, you know, foreign agencies, development partners, or corporations, right? I think ultimately this is the debate.
Well, unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally, so we cannot probably answer the second question, which, of course, regards to whether the Ugandan event was an election or, in fact, a selection. Some have, in fact, called it the moral equivalent of a coup. On that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Beth Treter, Vice President of the Department of Policy and Evaluation at the Millennium Challenge Corporation, Dr. J. Peter Palm, Director of the Africa Center of the Atlantic Council, and Emira Woods, an Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington, D.C. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next, and tomorrow morning is Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beta, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.